I referred to the lesson I was going to teach this afternoon, that I'm glad that so many of you with young children and grandchildren and everything are here, because I think it's really important. You know, the foundation of a strong faith, I've always, the elders at Kettering came to me last year, and one of the things that we recognized was a lot of young people grow up around the influence of the church, and they go away to college or they go away and they lose that sense of their faith. And it's challenged so much in our society. And you know, the Apostle Paul in 2 Timothy chapter 4, verse 10, he mentioned that Demas has forsaken me, loving this present world. Now, Paul wouldn't have mentioned that if it wasn't some kind of impact on him. And every time a Christian falls away, it's an impact on us, because we know that without God there isn't any hope. That the Apostle Paul said in 1 Corinthians 15th chapter, if we only have hope in this life, we're of all men most to be pitied. If all there is this life, what we have right now, then your life is just a vapor, as James says. And when it's over, it's over. But we that are children of God believe in something far greater than the world that we're in. And so when the elders came to me and we discussed the problems with watching young children grow up and they profess faith, they may even become Christians. And then at some point in time, they move away from home and their faith begins to waver and people start challenging them. And we recognize that. And I've got one granddaughter, believe it or not, that's already a Christian. She'll be 14 in January, which is hard to believe, since I'm only 28 myself. You know, but she'll be 14 in January, and then I have two other granddaughters who'll be 14 next year as well. I got so it's just amazing how time flies. But I was going to have. They asked what we could do, and what should we do to strengthen these young people's faith. And what I thought about was, well, what is it that they're challenged with? What is it the things they're having trouble with? So the elders asked me where I would go if I was going to build faith that was unshakable among our young people. And I said the first place I'd go is the first place that was written. I'd go to the book of Genesis. People said, the book of Genesis? Why would you go to the book of Genesis? And you'll find out here in a minute. But the book of Genesis is not taught enough. Now, if I was to ask you how much history is contained in the book of Genesis, I'd probably get all kinds of different answers. But I want you to understand something. There's a genealogy put in there that tells us how far from creation to the birth of Abraham, to the flood, to the birth of Abraham, and all these events that take place. And the book of Genesis contains 40% of all human existence. 40%, over 40% of all human existence. And it's important that God only mentioned the things that were important to the fact that what happened in Genesis chapter 3. Now, when you look at Genesis chapter 1, we have the creation and so forth. And God gets down in verse 31 in Genesis chapter 1 and says, and it was very good. God made a beautiful place. And he desired this relationship with man, and we find out what takes place, that sin separates us from God, and all the decay and the corruption that comes on the world. And people they always want to argue about this and so forth. Well, why did God create man? Well, I don't know, except he loved us and he cared about us. Well, why did he allow man to sin? Well, I don't know, except he didn't make robots. He made people with the eternal spirit that had the right to make a choice. Why did he allow temptation? Because if there was no temptation, there was no choice to be made. You just had to do what you had to do. And people want to question God. And so what we've got into a society that not only do they question God, they disavow the concept of God altogether. And then they use their means to tell people there is no God. Well, I got to tell you, I think we can answer a lot of questions when we look back at the book of Genesis. And it's an important thing. You know, Jesus made a principle in Luke chapter 8, verse 5 through 8. We go out and we spread the seed. And when we spread the seed of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the salvation through Jesus Christ, some of that seed's going to fall on thorny ground. Some of our kids are thorny ground. They get in there and it starts to grow. But you know what? The cares of the world choke them out. They get so entangled with the world that they lose sight of the fact that they're only here temporarily. And they lose sight that there's something far better that's prepared for us. So Matthew says, or Jesus said in Matthew chapter 7, that the wise man builds his house upon a rock. There's a foundation that a good life is built on. And we as Christians need to build a foundation that's under our children and under ourselves that is unshakable, that cannot be debated, cannot be taken out of. Because I think it's really important that we understand that everybody starts in this relationship with God, as 1 Peter says, as a baby. So when a child of God is born, Peter calls him in 1 Peter chapter 2 a newborn babe. Now, nobody would expect a newborn babe to know the nutrition that they need and for them to take it in themselves and become strong enough to sustain through life. So what happens is we feed them. So the question is what are we feeding our kids? And what have we failed to feed them that has left them weak and susceptible to the things of the world? You know, Peter says that when Jesus said you got to build your house upon the rock, Peter says in 2 Peter 2, a strong faith, or 2 Peter 1, a strong faith has to be built and growing. He says, given all diligence, add to your faith, virtue, knowledge, temperance, patience, godliness, brotherly kindness. He says you got to build on that foundation. It just doesn't sit there, but you got to build on the foundation. 2 Timothy 2:15, we're told to study to show ourselves approved as workmen that need not to be ashamed, rightly dividing, rightly understanding the word of truth. And you know, one of my favorite passages when I was growing up, probably the first one I memorized, other than John 3:16, was Psalm chapter 1. When David said, blessed is the man that walks not in the counsel of the ungodly, nor stands in the way of sinners, nor sits in the seat of the scornful, but his delights in the law of the Lord, and in that law he meditates day and night. And he shall be like a tree planted by the rivers of water. You know that? So David said, we meditate upon God, we think about God, and we become stronger in God because we think about those things. So it's important that a good foundation is laid for our children, one that's unshakable, that's steadfast, that they can understand. It's important that they build upon that rock, that they will find the characters and the nature that they need to have to serve God, that they rightly understand God's word, and that they meditate upon it. So we have to find, first of all, the first thing we have to do is lay that foundation. And everybody said, well, the foundation is Jesus Christ. Well, yes and no. The foundation starts in Genesis chapter 1 and verse 1. So they gave me the junior high class so I could study within the book of Genesis for 13 weeks. And I looked at him and said, seriously? I'm supposed to do Genesis in 13 weeks? Well, that's what we got it built for. But fortunately for me, the elders every once in a while come in and sit in the class. And one of the elders sat in the class the fourth week. He goes, we need this extended. You're not going to get done what you need to get done. I said, I told you that when we planned it. So they moved it to 6 months. Because what you have to do is you have to start at the basics and have children understand what you're dealing with when you're dealing with faith. And I think that's pretty important. But let me start by saying, you are people of faith. And your faith is that there's an eternal God who created all things. And we consist through Him. But let me tell you something. The world has faith too. People in the world, some people are humanists. They think humans are the highest creature available, the smartest creature available. And there's people called general evolutionists. And they have a faith. And their faith is everything just happened. Now I don't have a whiteboard or I would demonstrate this for you, but I just want you to think about this. When you listen to a general evolutionist, they try to make you believe that it's science, but it's not. It's faith. And I'll just give you an example. The creationist says that mind is eternal. The evolutionist says matter is eternal. Now, I want you to think about this. And what they'll always do, well, where did God come from? They'll ask you that question. Well, what's your answer to that? He always was. He always was. But you turn around and say, where did matter come from? What answer they got? They have no answer. It always was. It always existed. Since none of us were there when God was there, or none of us were there when matter was there, faith has to come from the ability to reason certain things. We don't know there's a God in the scientific nature. We never observed him. We didn't see him build the world. We don't know he's there. We know by faith. The evolutionists don't know that matter is eternal. They were not there. They cannot prove it, and they know it by faith. Both of these are faith issues. But when you come to teaching children, there's logical things that you can teach them that would demonstrate why it's more reasonable to believe in God than not believe in God. And so what I've done with them is I took them and I said, okay, now you take this pair of glasses here. Now, when you look at this pair of glasses, it's got these nose pads. Everybody got a pair of glasses? You got that? It's got those hinges on there, right? You got little screws that go in there. You got wires that hold the lenses in place. You got all these parts, right? Now, let's take this pair of glasses apart. And we're going to take it off piece by piece, everything off this pair of glasses. And I want you to put it in a paper bag, and I want you to shake it up. Shake it up. And pour it out. Will it come out looking like this? How many times would you have to pour the contents of that bag out before it came out like this? It never would come out like this. If you believe general evolution, that's what you have to believe. That matter is going to organize itself and become all living things. Now, what's even more ridiculous about general evolution is they say the matter spontaneously generated, some force acted upon the matter to make it start to generate. Well, where did the force come from? They do not know. Where was the force? They know nothing. Yet when they talk to our children in the schoolrooms and in classes, they try to make them think they're stupid for believing in God. Now, let me just tell you how these glasses were made. Because somebody with intelligence said that you can grind lenses and it'll help in the optics, it'll change this, and it'll go back and reflect in your eye, and you can read. I can just tell you something. Without these glasses, I can't read. And somebody in their mind said you could take glass or whatever, and you could form it as such that it will enhance that so you can read that. Now, that didn't just happen. Somebody in their mind thought about that, experimented with it, and it happened. Now, how are we going to get it to stick on his head? You know, his head's big. He's got little ears to hold him up or big ears to hold him up. How are we going to do that? Well, we're going to do these things here, and this is the invention we'll do to hold it in place. But it's going to make these ugly marks on his nose. Well, here's these pads. Everything that you and I know in the world is because of intelligence and intelligent design. Not because it just happened, but it's because intelligent design. So what you have to do is, after you have this discussion with them, that you get them thinking a little bit. So what we did is I went back to Genesis. I said, okay, so you know both theories that are out there. So let's start back in Genesis. So when you open your Bible to the book of Genesis, the first word you read in Genesis chapter 1 is, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Isn't that the first ones in your Bible? First one in my Bible. So I looked at my junior high class, and I said to them, okay, so in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. What was before the beginning? They looked at me. What do you mean? What was before the beginning? What is the beginning? And they looked at me. And I said, read the verse. What was before the beginning? They said, God. I said, okay, so this verse says that God existed before the beginning. Now, what else does it say that God did when this beginning started? It says, He created. Oh, okay, what's creation? So they start defining creation for me. So God created. Now, I just want you to picture this. I had a big box up on the board and said, this represents the beginning. So here's God outside that box. Now, I want you to remember that. God is outside the box. He is the creator. He's not part of the creation. He never was and never will be. He's not subject to anything that's in the box. He is God. You understand that? That's the difference between Him and you. So when you're talking to young people, say, okay, tell me what creation was. What did, well, He did the heaven. So inside the box, there's the heavens and the earth. There's a separation of day and night. There's the plants. There's the animals. There's that. All this. Okay. What else is in that box? Well, how about scientific law that we think of? You know, I can demonstrate one here to you in just a second. I'll pull something out here. What would you call that law? Gravity. How'd that happen? Well, you know what? God created the heaven and the earth, and in it there contains laws that rule the creation. But you know what's not in the creation? God's not in the creation. He's above creation. He created it. He commands it, and it is. See, the problem with science is they try to prove God doesn't exist by using the science that God created. That's the problem. They think by looking at science they could prove the non-existence of God because they want God to be subject to the laws that God created. God is not subject to the laws that He created. He is the creator of the laws that He created. You got that? Do we understand that? Our young people, when they go to school and teachers start telling them, I can't believe you believe in God. Well, why? It is the only reasonable thing to believe in for the existence of the creation because a mind created it and that mind's not subject to it. He doesn't live inside the creation. He lives outside the creation until. Now think about this. God lived outside His creation. He provided the creation. He gave the creation everything it needed and He let the creation have free will. But when the creation decided to choose to dishonor Him and serve themselves, you know what happened in John 1:1 and John 1:14? God came inside His creation. When you read Genesis 1, it says, in the beginning God created the heavens and earth. When you read John 1, it says, in the beginning was the Word. And the Word was with God, and the Word was God. The same was in the beginning with God. Now look at verse 3. All things were created by Him. So this Word that comes into the world, He's the creator. He's the creator of the world that we live in. And verse 14 says, and the Word, this eternal God, this eternal power, this being that was outside the creation became flesh and He came into the world and He dwelt among us and we beheld His glory of the only begotten of the Father full of grace and truth. The eternal God, the eternal Spirit that created all things came inside the creation. Well, why? Because man had sinned. Man had separated himself from God. Now, I want you to think about this. He made the creation and He gave man personal will to make a decision. Man violated the will. So man, the created, sins against the creator. Now, what can the man that sinned against the creator give him back? Nothing. Because everything's made by him. There is nothing that a human being can do to justify himself before God because we've sinned against the God who created all things. So since we couldn't do it, God came in to make the sacrifice so that we could be saved. God so loved, John 3 says, that He gave His only begotten Son to whosoever believed in Him should not perish but have everlasting life. God did not send His Son into the world to condemn the world. He sent His Son into the world that through Him they might be saved. That's what John 3:16 and 17 says. Jesus came into the world so we could be saved. The Creator came inside the world so you and I could be freed from our sin. And that's the only way we can be freed from the sin, through the perfect sacrifice of God dying for man. Well, wait a minute. He was a human being. And I know this boggles people's mind. He was a human being. He became flesh and dwelt among us. Philippians tells us he was made in the likeness of man. And he humbled himself, became obedient. Jesus was 100% man and 100% God. Well, that's not possible. Yes, it is. And you want me to demonstrate it to you? I don't know if we got any winos here, but I'll just ask this question. If you were going to make wine, what would you do? I bet you'd go get some grapes. You have Edith clean her feet and get in the pot and stomp those grapes, get all the juice out of them, wouldn't you? So you take those grapes, have somebody step on them, take the juice out of them, you put them in skins, you'd ferment it, wouldn't you? Wouldn't you? And you'd take this process, and you know they've got places where you store wine, and the longer this is there, the more valuable it becomes. But Jesus, in John chapter 2, goes to the wedding feast at Cana in Galilee. And when all that had been well drunk, there was no more wine. And his mom tells him, he said, "Woman, what do I have to do with you?" She said, "Take those 6 pots and go fill them with water." And they go fill them with water. And when they come back, the server of the feast tastes the water, and it's wine. Jesus didn't have to stomp grapes. He didn't have to wait, because God is not subject to his creation. He is the Creator. Jesus could change anything he wanted to change because he rules creation. I want you to think about that. Well, you'll read a couple chapters over. There's 5,000 people that are following Jesus. Jesus said, "Tell them to sit down. What do we got to feed them? We got 5 barley loaves and we have 2 fish." You know what you can't do? You can't feed 5,000 people with five barley loaves and 2 fish. You can't do it. But you know who can? Jesus can. But you know why? Because he's not subject to the laws of creation. He is the Creator. He is God. He's not subject to the laws that you and I have. You know, they leave that, and his servants go over in a boat, and all of a sudden, there's a storm. And I'll just almost bet that if you were in the boat on the storm, in a storm, that you wouldn't step out of that boat, because I'd almost bet you can't walk on water. But you know who can? Jesus can, because he's the Creator. He is not subject to the laws of creation. He becomes subject to the laws of human beings when he decides, "I'll be subject to it." And that's why he felt the pain, he felt the suffering, and he decided to die because that's what he needed. But Jesus, you know, Satan was right. Put yourself on the temple, throw yourself down. God will spare you. Yeah, well, you know, that's, yeah, Jesus. But you know what Jesus said? Don't tempt the Lord your God. Jesus said, "Don't tempt the Lord your God. I'm God. I know what I can do. I know what I can't do. And I'm not subject to you. And I'm not subject to the world, because I'm the Creator." And unless we teach our children that God is not a man thing, that God is not subject to the rules like you and I are, God is not going to get old and die. You know, and I got to tell you something. Sometimes brethren just drive me crazy. About 15 years ago, there was a question of whether God could create the world in 6 days. Folks, time didn't exist until in the beginning. God's not subject to time. He can do it in a nanosecond if he wanted to. He's not bound by the laws that you and I are bound by, because he's God. Don't try to humanize God. Don't let your children ever think God is like a human. He's not like a human. He is God. And it makes him different from anything that exists. And he has power over all things that exist. You want your children to have vibrant faith. You instill within them the concept that God is eternal, everlasting, all-powerful, and he's not like us. He's not subject to the things that we are. That's why time doesn't mean anything to him. Time is a part of his creation. Now, while we're subject to time because we are the creation, God is going to make you where you're never subject to time, because when he takes you home, time will mean nothing to you. Because you, he has put an eternal spirit. Your children have something inside of them that they need to understand. It's something that will never die again. It's eternal. It's in the nature and the likeness of God, given to us by the Creator, and provided for us so that we can serve Him, love Him, worship Him, care about Him, and give Him the honor He deserves because He is God. And you know, sometimes we get all hopped up about how important we are. When we start looking at these things, I remember Jesus' teaching. When they come to Him, He says, "Master, tell my brother to share the inheritance with me." And Jesus said, "Who made me a judge over you?" He said, "Be careful. A man's life does not consist in the abundance of things he possesses." There's a lot of rich people in the world. And let me tell you, they're not taking it with them. The only thing they have that will endure this is the fact that our God put an eternal spirit in you that will live forever. And when we're talking to our children, this needs to be real, because it is real. It's called faith. And you know, Hebrews says the faith is the substance of things we hope for. And it's our evidence of things we don't see. Faith is the substance of things we hope for. You know, Job asked the question, if a man dies, will he live again? But he knew it. He knew he was answerable to an eternal God, even though he may not understand him. If you don't read the book of Job annually, you should, because the last few chapters of that book, when God finally answers him, puts in perspective who we are and who God is. He asked Job, he said, "Where were you when I formed the foundations of the world?" Well, Job had to say, "I wasn't around. And neither was I, and neither was you. But God was." These people that don't know who God is, they will someday know who God is. They can deny it all they want, but what they're doing is they're living a faith that has no answer. If a man doesn't live again, then hope doesn't exist. We're all going to get old and die and just stay there. But Jesus came to give us life and to give it abundantly. You and I have an abundant life. We have a life that's forever, provided by God through His love for us and through the Son, Jesus Christ. And when we're teaching our children, and when we're teaching people we love, there's an easy explanation. The explanation is faith. Jesus looked at His disciples, and He says to them, "I have overcome the world." In other words, this world, this society you're living in, I have overcome it. It's not going to control me. And Jesus says, you can overcome it. Don't be tied to this world. It doesn't have anything that lasts. It's not important. Don't get overly impressed with how successful you've been. Don't be overly impressed with how poor you are. I got to tell you a side story. I love golf. It's one of my real weaknesses. I play over 100 rounds of golf every year. I know I'm a sick individual. I understand that. But I joined a country club. And the country club is a pretty nice country club. And they have people that work at the country club, but sometimes on the days off, those people can play the golf course. They're not allowed to eat in the restaurant, but they let them play. And one day, one of the people that wait on us asked if he could play with us. And two of the people that I play with, no, he's an employee. I looked at him and said, seriously? No, we don't play golf with the employees. I said, 50 years from now, where are you going to be? Oh, I'm going to be dead. I said, so is he. And you won't have anything you have here, and it won't make a difference on if you were a member or if you were a worker. It doesn't make any difference. But I'm going to tell you something. What will make a difference is how we view life. If you view life that this is the end, you're a miserable person with no hope. But Jesus came to give you life and give it abundantly. And the key to that life is firmly establishing faith based upon who God is and who you're not. He is the God of creation and the God of your salvation. And if there's people here this morning that need to name Jesus Christ as their Savior, we give this opportunity for you to do so. I appreciate the opportunity to speak here. I haven't done it in a long time. But I do appreciate the opportunity to be with you. But I just want you to know, if I don't see you again inside this realm, I pray I'll see you again. Because I am going to a city where the roses never fade, where the tree of life is blooming, and the streets with gold are laid. In this world we have our trials. Satan's temptation we must evade. But I am going to a city where the roses never fade. If it's your desire to do that, you have this opportunity. Well, together we stand and sing. Restore my spirit, Lord, I need restore.